Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Negotiators from Iran and a group of six countries, including the United States, worked Monday to close 18 months of talks and finalize their long-sought comprehensive agreement on Iran's nuclear program. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Vienna.
Today is the fourth self-imposed deadline here at the Iran nuclear negotiations in Vienna. But top-level ministers are still in closed-door meetings and have given no indication if or when they may have a deal. British Foreign Minister Philip Hammond is expected to arrive later today, completing the group of foreign ministers known as the P5 plus one.
In brief comments to the media within the last 24 hours, several top diplomats involved in brokering the accord said important issues remained to be resolved ahead of the self-imposed deadline, but had hinted the P5 plus one and Iran were close to having the complex document ready. Iraq announced Monday the start of an offensive to recapture its western Anbar province from Islamic State militants who control large areas, including the cities of Ramadi and Fallujah. The televised statement said the operation included Iraqi troops as well as Shiite and Sunni fighters. Iraq's government has made Anbar a priority since the Islamic State group seized Ramadi during a May offensive that prompted fresh criticism of the military and its response to the militants. Ramadi is about 125 kilometers west of the Iraqi capital Baghdad, where multiple bomb attacks Sunday killed at least 29 people and wounded more than 80 others. There was no immediate claim of responsibility, but similar waves of bombings have been attributed to the Islamic State. This is VOA News. Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari is expected to visit neighboring Cameroon sometime in the coming weeks. Chris Stein reports from VOA's regional bureau in Dakar on what can be expected when the heads of the two neighboring states, which have not always gotten along, meet.
Nigeria and Cameroon have butted heads before. Their most notable spat was over who owned the oil-rich Bekasi Peninsula on the coastal border. The spread of the Boko Haram insurgency from Nigeria into Cameroon has drawn the two countries together again. While the Islamist insurgent group's stated goal is to establish strict Islamic law in Nigeria's northeast, it has attacked northern Cameroon repeatedly and is thought to keep rear bases on its territory. President Buhari has pledged to defeat Boko Haram and is putting together a task force of troops from neighboring states to defeat the group. A senior research fellow at the Institute for Security Studies in South Africa, David Zunmeno, says Mr. Buhari will not be able to achieve the victory he campaigned on without Cameroon's help. Chris Stein for VOA News, Dakar.
A suicide bomber detonated his explosives-packed car near a security checkpoint in southeastern Afghanistan Sunday evening, killing at least 25 people, including women and children, the provincial police chief said. The bombing in Khost province also wounded dozens of others. Most of the victims are said to be civilians. The violence happened not far from an American military base in the Afghan province, which borders Pakistan. It was not immediately clear if the Taliban was behind the attack. Thailand is under heavy criticism for forcibly deporting more than 100 ethnic Uyghurs to China and is meeting with rights activists and others later this week to discuss the fate of 50 more who are still in Thailand. Ron Corbin reports.
Thailand's National Human Rights Commission Chief Nirawan Pitakwatchara will meet with representatives from the UN High Commission for Refugees and Rights Groups on Friday. The talks hope to salvage Thailand's hard-hit global reputation after deporting 109 ethnic Uyghur refugees back to China, triggering international condemnation, accusing the junta of breaching international human rights laws. China insists the Uyghurs sent back were travelling to join the Islamic State. Thai officials say they are sending a team to China to oversee the welfare of the 109 Uyghurs sent back last week. Rights activists say the outcome of China's meeting, led by the National Human Rights Commission, is expected to provide a clearer view on the Thai government's policy toward the Uyghurs. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
Serbia's Novak Djokovic, the world's number one men's tennis player, won his third Wimbledon title in the past 5 years Sunday in London, beating Roger Federer of Switzerland. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The World Health Organization says 33 people in South Sudan's capital have died from cholera since June out of 790 confirmed cases. The origin of the epidemic has been traced back to a displaced persons camp in Juba, where crowded, unsanitary conditions likely fueled the outbreak.
That's VOA's Gabe Jaslow reporting. Details coming up.
Also, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni reportedly will fly to Burundi tomorrow to try to mediate an end to the political crisis there. And Nigerian army sources say they foiled a weekend attempt to free Boko Haram suspects from a jail in the north.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports, music from Sierra Leone, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the aid agency Oxfam says the rising price of water in South Sudan is putting more people at risk from a cholera outbreak. VOA's Gabe Jaslow reports this is just one of the ways the economic impact of an ongoing civil conflict has worsened a humanitarian crisis in the country.
The World Health Organization says 33 people in South Sudan's capital have died from cholera since June out of 790 confirmed cases. The origin of the epidemic has been traced back to a displaced persons camp in Juba, where crowded, unsanitary conditions likely fueled the outbreak. But Oxfam country director Zlatko Gegic says the economic impact of civil conflict has made the situation worse.
We have seen skyrocketing prices of water, food and commodities. At the end, people are struggling to put food on the table and are paying less and less attention to clean water. Not because they want to, but because they have been put in such situation.
Prices for basic goods have risen in South Sudan as 19 months of violence has disrupted oil production, the key driver of the economy. Gegic says many families in Juba typically rely on private suppliers for clean water, and the rising price of fuel has increased the cost to consumers.
Those poorer neighborhoods of Juba are hit hardest, and some of those families have no means to buy any clean water anymore. So they are resorting to dramatic measures like drinking water from untreated resources, sometimes straight from the River Nile.
Cholera is transmitted through contaminated water or food. It is treatable in most cases, but can be deadly. Gegic says an intervention by aid agencies and South Sudan's Ministry of Health has helped control this outbreak, but says long-term investment in clean water and health infrastructure is needed to prevent a repeat of the situation. Gabe Jaslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni reportedly will fly to Burundi tomorrow to try to mediate an end to the political crisis there. Reuters news agency says Mr. Museveni will meet with government and opposition leaders. The crisis began in April when President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he would seek a third term in office. The opposition says that violates the constitution. Presidential elections are scheduled for July 21st. Also, AFP reports that Burundian security forces have arrested about 100 suspected rebels in the northeastern province of Muyanga. A local official says among those arrested were 30 supporters of opposition leader Agathon Rwasa. Also, police say last Friday about 80 people were arrested in northern Burundi near the Rwandan border. The arrests followed clashes with police. Since April, more than 70 people have died in political violence. Nearly 160,000 people have fled the country.
The French news agency reports that Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has fired his national security advisor and the chiefs of the nation's army, navy, and air force. The announcement was made today, but no explanation was given for the move. There has been strong criticism of Nigeria's prolonged effort to combat Boko Haram extremists who have plundered three states in northern Nigeria for 6 years. When he spoiled Goodluck Jonathan's re-election bid earlier this year, Buhari pledged to rid his government of corruption and to aggressively prosecute the war against Boko Haram. In other news, Nigerian army sources say they foiled a weekend attempt to free Boko Haram suspects from a jail in the north. The attack on the jail at the town of Difa was one of several clashes in the region blamed on Boko Haram insurgents. A military spokesman said three insurgents and one soldier died in the Saturday shootout in Difa. On the same day, a suicide bomber killed 14 people in a market in N'Djamena, the capital of Chad. The bomber, who was disguised as a woman, detonated his explosives when police tried to stop him. Another 10 died in the Nigerian village of Ngamdu when gunmen attacked the village 60 miles north of Maiduguri, a large city and the birthplace of Boko Haram. Earlier today, civilian self-defense forces reported one member died when a suicide bomber exploded at a checkpoint outside Maiduguri.
Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari is expected to visit neighboring Cameroon sometime in the coming weeks. Christine reports from VOA's regional bureau in Dakar on what can be expected when the heads of the two neighboring states, which have not always gotten along, meet.
Nigeria and Cameroon have butted heads before. Their most notable spat was over who owned the oil-rich Bekasi Peninsula on the coastal border. The spread of the Boko Haram insurgency from Nigeria into Cameroon has drawn the two countries together again. While the Islamist insurgent group's stated goal is to establish strict Islamic law in Nigeria's northeast, it has attacked northern Cameroon repeatedly and is thought to keep rear bases on its territory. President Buhari has pledged to defeat Boko Haram and is putting together a task force of troops from neighboring states to defeat the group. Mr. Buhari has already visited Chad and Niger, both of which have been attacked by the group, and has said he will visit President Paul Biya in Cameroon. President Buhari, a Muslim, is expected to make the trip after Ramadan ends this week. A senior research fellow at the Institute for Security Studies in South Africa, David Zunmeno, says Mr. Buhari will not be able to achieve the victory he campaigned on without Cameroon's help.
And I think Cameroon and Nigeria understand very well the porosity of the border and the capacity of the organization of Boko Haram to move from one point to the other.
Zunmeno says this summit will focus on turning over a new leaf between the newly elected President Buhari and President Biya, who has been in office since 1982.
It would be very important to restate the engagement of Nigeria to cooperate with Cameroon at different levels to be able to respond effectively to the threat of Boko Haram, to put aside the differences that emerge from the Bakassi dispute and see where Cameroon and Nigeria need to strengthen their relation.
The regional task force will be based in Chad, but commanded by a Nigerian. Chris Stein for VOA News, Dakar.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 13 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. The aid agency Oxfam says the rising price of water in South Sudan is putting more people at risk from a cholera outbreak. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni reportedly will fly to Burundi tomorrow to try to mediate an end to the political crisis there. And Nigerian army sources say they foiled a weekend attempt to free Boko Haram suspects from a jail in the north. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
Well, the UN Special Envoy on Ebola says health experts are worried that a third of the new infections discovered each week in West Africa come from unknown sources. David Nabarro told a World Health Organization meeting in South Africa today that about 30 new cases of the Ebola virus are found each week. He said many of the newly infected persons are not on contact lists. That is, people being monitored because they have been in contact with someone previously diagnosed with an Ebola infection. Since the epidemic began 16 months ago, more than 11,000 have died in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. The rate of infection has declined sharply since then. However, all three countries continue to find small numbers of people newly infected with the virus.
And the third International Conference on Financing for Development is underway in Addis Ababa. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon opened the event saying 2015 must be a year for global action.
In September in New York, the international community will adopt a new set of sustainable development goals for the coming 15 years. In December in Paris, the governments have committed to reach a first-of-its-kind universal and meaningful climate change agreement. But without resources, commitments will amount to little more than promises on paper. That is why it is encouraging that this year of action begins here with you. You have recognized that in a world in which both global population and resources constraints are growing, development finance needs a reboot. This conference is a starting point for a new era of cooperation and global partnership.
Mr. Ban says with the adoption of the Addis Ababa Action Agenda, the conference is taking a crucial step towards sustainable development.
The agenda presents an ambitious financing framework. It puts us on the right path to implement the post-2015 development agenda and the sustainable development goals. The framework is universally inclusive. We aim to leave no one behind. It emphasizes the importance of economic growth for developing countries.
The UN chief says countries are responsible for their own economic and social development, but he says national efforts need to be supported by an enabling international economic environment.
Financing needs for sustainable development are high, but the challenges are surmountable. Solutions lie in using all sources of finance, public, private, national, and international. These must be matched by strengthened public policies and regulatory frameworks and incentives for changes in consumption and production patterns. The new agenda thus recognizes the central role of public policies in catalyzing private investment in sustainable development.
The Addis Ababa Action Agenda calls for social protection and public services for all, including health, education, energy, water, and sanitation. It also includes a commitment to increase official development assistance, the transfer of relevant technologies, cooperation on tax matters to stop illicit financial flows, financial support for gender equality, and strong action to deal with climate change. The third International Conference on Financing for Development runs through Thursday.
A new UN report says it will cost an additional $267 billion a year to eradicate hunger by 2030. The report's been released in conjunction with the third International Conference on Financing for Development, which opened today in Addis Ababa. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The report's been released by the Food and Agriculture Organization, the International Fund for Agricultural Development, and the World Food Program. Despite progress in recent years, it's estimated 800 million people still do not have enough to eat each day. Most of them are in rural areas. FAO Director General José Graziano da Silva says the current effort to end hunger and extreme poverty, what he calls the business-as-usual approach, is not enough. The report calls for a combined social protection and investment scenario. It would use public-funded transfers to ensure the very poor simply reach the poverty level set by the World Bank of $1.25 a day. The FAO chief says the $267 billion figure does not seem so large when looked at in simple ways.
If we divide this number by the poor that we have already, or the hunger that we have already, we got an average number, $160 per year. It's the cost of a cell phone.
He says it's also the cost of a cow in Vietnam, a mule in Brazil, or dinner for two in Rome. World Food Program Director Etherin Cousins says a dramatic shift in thinking is needed to break the cycle of hunger and poverty.
This publication of this report is timely because it represents an important contribution to the growing body of evidence clearly detailing the investments required in agriculture, social protection, and safety nets to achieve the shared ambitious outcome.
She stresses the importance of this week's International Conference on Financing for Development,
where the world must agree upon a viable investment framework, investment financial framework, for this ambitious sustainable development agenda.
The UN report says that social protection in the form of cash transfers will eliminate hunger immediately and will improve nutrition by allowing the poor to afford more diverse and healthier diets. Cash transfers are direct payments to poor people, usually from governments. The report adds that most of the required investment usually comes from the private sector, especially farmers. But it says those funds need to be complemented by additional public sector investments in rural infrastructure, transport, health, and education. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
A new study finds that rural farmers have a big potential in reducing carbon emissions, and it may not be as big a burden as some believe. The International Fund for Agricultural Development, EFAD, and the CGIAR Research Program on Climate Change, Agriculture, and Food Security, CCAFS, says helping farmers adapt to the impacts of climate change can also significantly reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The report shows that smallholder farmers are key to solving climate change threats and food security challenges. With proper investments, the report says farmers can restore degraded ecosystems and reduce agriculture's carbon footprint and still feed a growing planet. Eva Wallenberg is one of the authors of the CGIAR report. She describes the mitigation potential of smallholder farmers.
We believe the potential would be about 1 gigaton of CO2 equivalents per year for all of agriculture. And if we estimate that about one-third of emissions come from smallholders now, we would then extrapolate to say that about 0.3 gigatons would be possible. But that is a very rough estimate based both on population numbers that come from a variety of different sources, modeling that relies on many assumptions, and so these numbers need to be treated with some caution.
What does that actually mean for farmers in terms of them being able to adapt to these weather conditions, such as unexpected heavy rains and drought?
So the techniques that we're promoting are not only low emissions, but they are enabling farmers to be less vulnerable to climate change by virtue of increasing the efficiency, especially of different inputs. So, for instance, in the case of paddy rice, and thinking now specifically of the Mekong Delta in Vietnam, water shortages in the Mekong due to sea levels dropping and saltwater intrusion into the delta area have meant that there's less water for irrigation. And the Vietnamese government has been very interested in how to save water. At the same time, we know that we can reduce emissions from paddy rice, namely methane, by draining the field midway through the season and even draining the field several times, because that reduces the bacteria that actually produce the methane. And those bacteria can only survive when the fields are flooded. They're anaerobic bacteria. We can address both problems. We can save water and we can reduce the methane. And they're doing that by controlling the pumping of water, the irrigation systems into these paddy fields.
Would these emissions work also in Africa?
many parts of Africa were expecting less rainfall and more erratic rainfall, and so there could be trade-offs because irrigation at the same time is reducing risk, and so you'd have to find the balance between how much you're reducing risk by irrigating but draining the field at an appropriate time. For East Africa, though, I should say what we're concentrating on primarily is reduction of emissions from livestock. About 80% of the emissions are from livestock. There's huge interest among the countries in accessing climate finance through nationally appropriate mitigation actions, which is a UNFCCC mechanism. One of the opportunities that we see is the sustainable intensification of livestock, and namely improving the feed, doing what's called zero grazing, so enabling the livestock to be fed in place rather than grazing freely, and also especially enabling better feeding during the dry season so that production can be more even throughout the year. And these methods not only improve the overall productivity of the livestock, and in this case I'm thinking mostly of cattle, they also obviously will reduce the emissions because improved feed reduces the dry digestible matter and that reduces the methane that the cow will emit. We're also looking somewhat at improved manure management, but the real focus of our work is on the improved productivity of the cattle through this improved feed and the zero grazing and then reducing emissions as well.
Ultimately, of course, the goal is to reduce poverty and food insecurity. So how do these measures, how will they impact the quality and quantity of food for people?
We've estimated that these measures, based on a business case analysis, will increase the net revenue to farmers, this is per household, by about $680 to $2,400 U.S. dollars. And that this also reduces emissions by 3.3% nationally relative to Kenya's 2010 emissions. So in terms of food production, farmers will not only have higher food productivity, they'll be producing more milk, but perhaps more importantly, because we've seen that income is more closely associated with relieving food insecurity than actual production by smallholders, that these are huge increases in farmers' incomes, and we expect that to play a significant role in alleviating food insecurity.
Eva Wallenberg is the flagship leader for low emissions agriculture for CGIAR. She spoke with me from Paris, France.
This is Africa News Tonight. With Kim Lewis, I'm Yehei Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The aid agency Oxfam says the rising price of water in South Sudan is putting more people at risk from a cholera outbreak. And a Nigerian army source says they foiled a weekend attempt to free Boko Haram suspects from a jail in the north. Coming up, we'll have music from Sierra Leone. And in our feature segment, in Kenya, pregnant women satisfy a curious craving by eating stones. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Suhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. And, of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports with Tati Abeje and Jonah Haskell, the dynamic duo, sitting in today for Sonny Young, who is out. And hello to both of you.
Sporty greetings to you, Kim and Yeheus, holding the fort for the great Sonny Young today with my colleague, Jonah Haskell. And speaking of Jonah, Jonah kicks off the show today with his daily Wimbledon update. It's all yours, Jonah.
Thanks, Tati. Novak Djokovic and Serena Williams are your 2015 Wimbledon men's and women's champions. The most prestigious tournament in tennis concluded over the weekend at the All England Club in London. On Saturday, American Serena Williams justified her number one ranking by defeating Spaniard Garbiñe Muguruza in a tight two-set final, 6-4, 6-4. Appearing in her first final at a major, Muguruza, who is just 21, will have many more shots at winning Wimbledon in her career if she continues to play at the high level that she did in London. Serena, on the other hand, is in the second half of her career but is playing the best tennis of her life. She has now won 28 consecutive matches and can place her sixth Wimbledon trophy next to those from the 2015 French and Australian Opens and the 2014 U.S. Open. This will be the first time that a player has held all four major trophies at the same time since Serena herself did it in 2002 and 2003. If Williams can continue her unbeaten streak and win the U.S. Open in September this year, she will become the first woman to complete the Grand Slam in women's singles since the great Steffi Graf completed the feat in 1988. After she won, Serena spoke what it was like to win the Serena Slam.
It is really a great feeling. The moment is still setting in a little bit, and I'm just really excited about it because I didn't want to talk about the Serena Slam, and I honestly wouldn't have thought last year after winning the U.S. Open I would win the Serena Slam at all. It's super exciting. I just knew I wanted to win Wimbledon this year. Of all the Grand Slams, it was the one that I hadn't won in a while. And so I was like, I really want to win Wimbledon. And, you know, it happened. So just amazing. It feels really, really good.
I'm sure it does. On Sunday, the men's final featured a clash of titans as world number one and defending men's Wimbledon champ Novak Djokovic took on world number two Roger Federer, who is a seven-time winner at Wimbledon. An intense match was delayed by rain in the third set, but the weather eventually let up, and Djokovic's superb passing shot proved too much for Federer as the Joker won the match 7-6, 6-7, 6-4, 6-3. It was a nice rebound for Novak after he lost in the final of the French Open to Stan Wawrinka in June, and along with the Australian Open, this is Djokovic's second major win of the year. After the match, Djokovic spoke about his career success so far.
I'm very proud with all the success that I had so far in the career and everything I reached. And if you know, you would ask me as a 14-year-old back in Serbia trying to find my way, if, you know, that this is how I'm going to end up, you know, at 28. Of course, I would sign the deal and take it right away.
And I think any of us would take that deal right away. The final major of 2015 will be the U.S. Open, played in New York from August 31st until September 13th.
Thanks, Jonah. And Jonah will be back a little later with another report. In the Gold Cup, the U.S. defeated Haiti on Friday in their second Group A match 1-0. The game happened at Gillette Stadium in Foxborough, Massachusetts. The U.S. now advances to the knockout stage of the Gold Cup. U.S. forward Clint Dempsey scored the only goal in the game for the U.S. It happened in the 47th minute after receiving a pass from teammate forward Giazzi Zardes. Dempsey has scored all three of the team's goals so far in the Gold Cup tournament. USA goalkeeper Brad Guzan saved four shots from going into the goal. With their victory, the U.S. has locked up first place in Group A with 6 points. They will play their final Group A match against Panama today. The game will take place at the Sporting Park in Kansas City, Kansas. Here again
is Jonah Haskell with the latest on Tour de France. Riders in the most prestigious bicycle race in the world are getting a well-earned rest today. The Tour de France takes a day off after stage 9. After having started over a week ago in the Netherlands before winding its way through Belgium and then along the north coast of France, the race is now almost halfway over. The current leader is Christopher Froome, who, despite being listed as British, was born in Nairobi, Kenya. Froome, who rides for Team Sky, has a 12-second lead over second-place TJ Van Garderen of the United States and the BMC Racing Team. There is one African team in the competition this year, called MTN Kubeka. It is made up of South African and Eritrean riders. Although the team is currently in last place, Daniel Tekle Haimanot of Dibarwa, Eritrea, has been a bright spot for the team. Daniel currently holds the polka dot jersey, awarded at the end of each stage to the best climber in the field. In other words, Tekle Haimanot is the best in the race at biking up mountains, and it is not particularly close as he has come in first place of the climber rankings in 4 consecutive stages. The race kicks off again in the south of France on Tuesday as riders will begin trekking through the Pyrenees Mountains to the on the border with Spain before they cut out east across France to the Swiss Alps before finishing the final stage on the Champs-Élysées in Paris.
And finally, here is a recap of the National Basketball Association's free agency activity. One of the big-name free agents, LaMarcus Aldridge, announced he will be taking his talents back to his home state of Texas. There, he will join the San Antonio Spurs. He signed a contract with the Spurs for 4 years and $80 million. Aldridge previously played with the Portland Trail Blazers for 9 seasons, making the All-Star team 4 times in his career. He will be joining a team that is led by his idol, Tim Duncan, and other talented players like Tony Parker, Manu Ginobili, Danny Green, Kawhi Leonard, and David West. West also signed with the Spurs by taking a huge pay cut just to compete for a championship. Marc Gasol has signed a 5-year, $100 million contract to remain with the Memphis Grizzlies. DeAndre Jordan will remain with the Los Angeles Clippers after changing his mind about signing with the Dallas Mavericks. And the other big-name free agent, LeBron James, will remain with the Cleveland Cavaliers after signing a 2-year, $47 million contract. That's it for this edition of the Sunny Side of Sports with my colleague Jonah Haskell. I'm VOA's Toddy Abeje. Back to you, Kim and Yeheyes.
Thank you, Toddy, and thank you, Jonah. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up in Kenya, pregnant women satisfying a curious craving by eating stones. And next, orphans in Zimbabwe benefiting from a fishery project to alleviate poverty. But first, some music. Here is Vicky Fornaf, Sierra Leone, with Thank You.
Thank you for keeping in your memories. Thank you, oh yeah, I say thank you for showing me. together we can live forever. Tell you thank you where you make we embrace one another. Tell you thank you where we show love to one another. I
family, I want to take this opportunity for tell una plenty, plenty thank you for una prayer and the love una show to me during the time where I been get accident. I want to say thank you very much and God bless una. For all the love you show to me,
thank you.
The caring you show to me,
thank you.
For keeping me in your memories,
thank you.
Oh yeah, I say thank you.
For showing me your love,
thank you, thank you, thank you. For all the love you show to me,
thank you.
The caring you show to me,
thank you.
For keeping me in your memories,
thank you.
Vicky Forna of Sierra Leone with thank you.
Okay, thank you. Well, in Kenya, it is not unusual to see pregnant women satisfying a curious craving by eating stones. Extracted from quarries and traditionally sold at roadside stalls, the stones, known locally as Odawa, are now finding their way into mainstream markets despite the better advice of doctors. Rael Ambor has the story.
Joyce Navtutu, a 29-year-old mother of two, says she could not resist the Odawa craving during both of her pregnancies. All of a sudden, she had a natural craving to eat stones.
Well, I was pregnant, especially this last pregnancy. Yeah, there's a time I just woke up and I felt like, let me try this. Okay, when you pour some water on soil or something like that, you feel there's like a smell. So that smell was the one which was like, I felt it was smelling nice, so I felt like eating. I started eating, and then I could not stop.
The craving and eating of non-food items such as clay, dirt, or sand is quite common in Kenya among pregnant women. Eating the marble-sized stones has spread to many towns and is sold at roadsides, in small markets, and shopping malls in urban centers. Leah Adhiambo, a broker in the trade, supplies most of these stones to high-end supermarkets. She says the habit has become increasingly popular and supermarkets have warmed up to the idea of stocking their shelves with the stones.
Sailors, we realized that the demand of this stone was high amongst pregnant women of all ages, irrespective of class. The reason we package them is so that they may look appealing to attract a certain class of women who, let's say, cannot go to look for the stones deep within the market.
Leah is quick to admit that the stones are selling and it is becoming a profitable business.
We stock the shelves almost every week, which means that the stones are selling.
Experts say the craving to eat Odawa is largely due to a deficiency of vital minerals like calcium in the body, and that this may indicate a serious medical condition. Jane Mwangi, a doctor at Miliki Afya Clinic in Nairobi, explains.
During pregnancy, there is depletion of calcium and a lot of minerals in the body due to the demand. So I think they go for those stones because to some extent they contain those minerals. So most of the time they go to look for those minerals in the stones instead of coming to the hospitals and being given the supplements they need.
Mwangi says the stones can also potentially cause infections and other problems. Recent research by African Council for the Gifted and Talented also suggests that eating stones during pregnancy can affect children's health and their ability to learn. So while the trend may become more fashionable, according to doctors, the risk probably outweighs the benefits. Rael Ombor, for VOA News, Nairobi.
Villagers in Zimbabwe, Mashonaland, West Province, are among those benefiting from a fishery project to alleviate poverty. Arthur Chigoriwa reports.
Give a man a fish and feed him for a day. Teach a man to fish and you feed him for a lifetime. So goes an English adage. Villagers in Mangura's Richmond area have been taught how to keep fish and are now reaping the benefits. They were not fed for a day, but imparted with the necessary skills to cater for their needs. It all started when a local organization, Pamoacha, donated 1,500 fish and feeding material to local people and showed them modern ways of conducting this type of farming. The project was set up at Richmond Primary School and first managed by teachers and the School Development Association before it being embraced by the whole community. A swimming pool once used by a white commercial farmer was converted into a fish pond. It has not all been rosy, as the villagers at first encountered several problems like limited fish farming knowledge. One of the fish farmers, Munjozi Wansompa, says they did not even have an idea on when to clean, empty and refill the fish pond.
My challenges, we faced challenges on water. Pumping of water in and out, we faced a very high challenge because the person who was assisting us with the pumping of water in the pond, he used his own source of water to assist us.
All this has almost been overcome, as Rose Kachambra, a mother of four children, is among local people who say the fish project has transformed their lives.
This project is good for us. We can now get relish. And fish is nutritious.
Another beneficiary, Muchadei Garawaziva, a mother of three, says apart from eating fresh fish, most villagers are now thinking of having similar projects in their homesteads.
Aiwa, fish that's refresh.
We eat fish when they are still fresh. I'm planning to have my own fish project at my homestead because I realize that it is easy to look after them.
Innocent Wachenuka, a teacher at Richmond Primary School who kick-started the project, says they are now paying fees for 26 children with money derived from selling fish.
Okay, this project is going to help disadvantaged people in the community, like my orphans. They're going to benefit. So we are going to pay some school fees for the disadvantaged people in the community. And the community also going to buy fish for their relish.
Wansomba says the fish project is growing every day.
The community is getting an overview or an eyesight due to the fact that they are seeing now that the project can actually bring something to their table, can fetch money for them, for their survival. So there are clubs within the community who are buying fingerlings from us. For example, already we've got one club at a certain area at Kaswa, we have bought about 1,000 fingerlings from us. So instead of selling big fish, we are now selling the fingerlings, which is an advantage to us.
He says they sell 5 palm-sized fish for $1 and 1,000 fish for $100.50. The villagers currently have 4 pools for conducting the business after only starting with one last year in May. Pamoacha director Precious Napi says they are happy that local communities are becoming self-reliant at a time when most Zimbabweans are struggling to make ends meet due to the current harsh economic environment in the country. Reporting from Nichinoi, this is Arthur Chigoriwa.
Africa Africa News tonight on The Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday to Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiyas Wahib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Jackson Mvunganyi, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Top leaders in Burundi appear to be digging in despite growing international pressure and concern over the Central African nation's political crisis. Seeking to mediate an end to the crisis, which has sparked often violent street protests, the United States named Senegalese diplomat Abdoulaye Batali as special envoy to the Great Lakes region, replacing Saïd Djinnit of Algeria. The government of Burundi rejected the appointment, saying that a UN report critical of Burundi's June 29th parliamentary elections was biased and unfair. Tensions with the international community could be exacerbated as Burundi heads into the July 15th presidential election. President Pierre Nkurunziza remains intent to run for a third term, despite a planned boycott by major opposition parties and a lack of international observers to monitor the vote. The president's continued disregard for the Arusha Agreement and its term limit provisions has resulted in dozens of deaths and an exodus of over 144,000 Burundians to neighboring countries. The economy is in free fall, causing millions to suffer. The decision to proceed with last month's parliamentary vote, despite the complete absence of the necessary conditions for credible elections, further exacerbated an already dire situation. The United States joins with the African Union, the United Nations, and other regional bodies and leaders in urging President Nkurunziza to place his nation's welfare above his own political ambitions and participate in dialogue with the opposition and civil society to identify a peaceful solution to this deepening crisis. This presidential vote should be delayed until conditions are in place for free, fair, and peaceful elections. Due to the precarious political and security situation there, and the government's unwillingness to engage in good-faith efforts to negotiate a solution, the United States has suspended several security assistance programs on which it has cooperated with Burundi. In response to abuses committed by police during the political protests, we are suspending all International Law Enforcement Academy and anti-terrorism assistance training for Burundian law enforcement agencies. We have also suspended upcoming training for the Burundian military under the Department of Defense's Section 1206 Train and Equip Program, as well as training and assistance under the Africa Military Education Program. Finally, during our upcoming review of Burundi's eligibility for the trade preferences available to it under the African Growth and Opportunity Act, we will consider ongoing violence and instability and the government of Burundi's lack of respect for the rule of law in determining its eligibility for continuing these important trade preferences.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
And the ball.